thank you, Charles, and thank you all for being here. It's wonderful to be back. I've only been back in Charlottesville now for like 48 minutes. But I'm seeing things I didn't ever that weren't here before. It's a little disconcerting always to be out of place. But I wrote two books I wasn't supposed to write. And sometimes when I go to high schools to talk to kids and they ask me for a title for my talk, I entitle it, "When Doing the Wrong Thing is the Right Thing." But the very first thing I say to the kids is, you know, sometimes you have to do the wrong thing, but I'm like the guy who juggles chainsaws. Don't try this at home. Don't go do something that might lose you your job later in life and so on. Because if I had written this before I got tenure, of course, I'd be out. I'd be working at Walmart, probably. But let me read to you. Let me begin by reading the prologue to Waiting for Snow in Havana, which is the last thing I wrote. As Charles explained to you, I wrote this in a period of 3 months, writing every night. I rewrote nothing, absolutely nothing. It was my lovely wife, Jane, her advice was, don't do what you do with your history. Don't fuss over the writing. Don't rewrite anything. Just forge ahead. So that's what I did. And I sold the manuscript 2 weeks after I finished without changing a word. So this is the second draft. And it was reduced by about 15 to 20%. What I ended up taking out, actually, was the professor. I had to strangle the professor, because every time I used metaphor, I would explain it. I felt uncomfortable just letting the metaphors hang there. So I got pretty psychic with my editor. I knew what she was going to ask me to take out, and it was always the professor explaining. But I wrote this as fiction, even though it was not fiction. As a historian and scholar used to university presses who had just cashed a check for two books with Cambridge University Press, and the royalties for the entire year for two books was $17. I thought, nobody reads nonfiction. I better write a novel. But then my editor, who's a very smart woman, Rachel Klayman, who also edited President Obama's Audacity of Hope, she's very sharp. But she ended up getting fired from Simon & Schuster after she finished my book because she took such great care. She was too slow. So they canned her. She's now with Crown Books, and she's doing very well. But she discovered that this was not fiction when I confessed to her that it wasn't. And then she wouldn't let me publish it as fiction. And I was so mad. I was so angry that this is the last thing I wrote. I wrote the preface. It'll be the structure for my talk for the next 25 minutes or so. It's this, what I say in here. This is not a work of fiction, but the author would like it to be. Oh, yeah, he would. We improve when we become fiction, each and every one of us. And when the past becomes a novel, our memories are sharpened. Memory is the most potent truth. Show me history untouched by memories, and you show me lies. Show me lies not based on memories, and you show me the worst lies of all. If all the characters in this book are fictional, none of them knows it yet. All resemblances to actual persons were preordained before the creation of the world. It matters little that the names don't always match, a reference to the fact that I spent 3 hours with the lawyer for Simon & Schuster discussing whose name should be changed to avoid lawsuits. All the incidents and dialogue come straight from God's imagination, as does the author himself and the reader. Still, all of us are responsible for our own actions. Not even Fidel is exempt from all this, nor Che, nor his chauffeurs, nor his mansion, nor the many Cubans who soiled their pants before they were shot to death, nor the 14,000 children who flew away from their parents, nor the love and desperation that caused them to fly. That last reference is to the airlift that brought me here, which suddenly, you know, we have a similar situation, all these unaccompanied children showing up. Now, we used to be, my airlift used to be the largest exodus of unaccompanied children in the Western Hemisphere. We've been beaten by miles and miles now with all this. And I was actually interviewed by Al Jazeera yesterday because even they are interested in finding the parallels with the airlift. 14,000 kids. Our parents sent us in utter desperation to the United States because they were losing us, and they were losing us fast. All the kids were being sent to work camps far from home. Some kids were being sent to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. And, of course, no one on Earth, and especially Cubans at that time, thought that the Castro regime would last more than another year or two. So it was a temporary arrangement. But all our parents said to us, you know, there is this chance, kind of like those commercials for medications on television. You know, this could happen. We may never see you again. You may never see us again. For many parents, it was like Sophie's Choice, you know. Some parents never saw their children again, including my father. And I'm mentioning all this because the reason I went crazy in the summer of 2000 is not just the fact that I was turning 50, although that had a lot to do with it. It's also the fact that my oldest son at that time was turning 11, which was my age when I left. But worst of all, the thing that tipped me over the edge was the news stories about Elian Gonzalez, who was going to be sent back to hell after his mother died, getting him out of hell. The story was totally wrong the way it was being told by the American news media, and you could not escape it. And there was an element of just a sheer ignorance that not only baffled me, but irritated me to no end. So I wrote to every news organization in the United States and every magazine, print or electronic media, please put this in context, this Elian Gonzalez story. This government doesn't care about children being with their parents. This government intentionally separated hundreds of thousands of families. The Cuban government couldn't have cared less about my dad. And to this day, I'm choking up. I wonder what it was like for him to walk past our room for so many years, waiting, 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 waiting. Yet the same government kept saying, this boy needs to be with his father. I didn't get a single response to any of my letters written on my ostensibly impressive Yale stationery, which proved to be no better than toilet paper. Not one acknowledgement. So I went insane and wrote the memoir because I thought, as a historian, right, I knew narrative is what gets people. You can talk till you're blue in the face. You can have 50,000 op-eds in every newspaper, and you're not going to change anyone's mind. You're not going to get to them to the truth of what happened. First-person narrative will do it. Here's the funny part of this. By playing this game with myself that I was going to publish my own life as fiction, I avoided the worst temptation that any person has when writing about themselves, which is to make themselves look better. I put everything that was nasty and awful about my life and my history, the things that I have done in this book, and then Rachel Klayman wouldn't let me take them out. And I was stuck. And what she said was, the more warts you have, the more defects, the more loathsome that you are, more inclined people will be to believe the rest of your story. So I avoided the problem that sidetracked Oprah's author, was it 12 years ago or whatever. Writing your own life as fiction does sharpen your memory. If you have to turn yourself into a character and everyone in your life into a character, immediately you bypass a great problem that many writers have, which is, how do I get the totality of this person across? Well, from my own reading of fiction, I knew that, you know, characters are never fully three-dimensional. They have certain quirks, and you emphasize those quirks and so on. Now, here's another item. I grew up in a religiously mixed household, but very religious. Of course we were Catholic. My father's family was Catholic, but they were also theosophists and spiritists who conducted seances and believed in reincarnation. My father not only believed in reincarnation, but claimed that he could remember his past lives. And in one of his past lives, he had been King Louis XVI of France. My mother had been Marie Antoinette. My brother had been one of his children. A boy he picked up in the street and adopted had been the Dauphin, whom he recognized from a previous life. I, however, was not a Bourbon. He would never tell me who I was. But here's the funny part, and I'm getting into the religion part. Every single review that appeared, everyone except the New Yorker, said I had gotten carried away with my magical realism. One Canadian review actually said that I was so over the top, it actually hurt the book, because how could my father have performed his duties as a judge being so insane, right? So I had to laugh and laugh and laugh, because there was no magical realism in my book. I actually toned everything down. And I couldn't put, not just half, but, you know, 80% of it, I couldn't put it into the book. Such as the only time I got angry with my father. He was teaching me to play pool on a billiard table. And he said, you know, I haven't played this game in 3 lifetimes. And I got so angry at him. It's the only time I yelled at him, stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Also, it's very funny because my house is filled with religious art, Baroque Spanish religious art, and objects like, we had slivers of the True Cross, you know, but you know, they're everywhere. They multiplied on their own, so. But I used to have these dreams, which I recount in the memoir, again, as a character, as this little boy who was frightened by all these religious objects. I did have these recurring nightmares that Jesus would show up at my dining room window carrying his cross with his face thick with blood, and he'd just stare at me. And in my dream, as a child, I knew what he wanted of me, which was not nice. It's not comfortable. It's not smooth or soft. He wanted total sacrifice. Because, I picked all this up at school. I got all this from my Catholic education. My father had his reincarnation business, and he took communion without going to confession. So you see the mess I grew up with. But anyway, the reviewers, too, and in question and answer periods when I give talks, people mistake my dreams for real visions. And they say, does Christ still appear to you? I said, no. I said, it was a dream. It's a dream, and the dreams stopped. I don't see that anymore. But again, people assume that I'm getting carried away. or that I'm a little insane, you know, that I have visions of Jesus and so on. But here's what I did with this, because as I was writing it, I had this feeling that I was free-falling. And I will never jump out of a plane with a parachute, but I assume that this is the adrenaline rush that people feel when they do this. It felt great to be free-falling. But I kept hearing the splat at the end. But one of the things that kept me focused and kept me from getting too frightened and stopping the project was the fact that I had picked something up from my Jesuit professors in college, which was to be sneaky, to be as sneaky as possible, to do what Ignatius Loyola used to do before he established the Jesuits when he was a layman. This is what he would do. He'd already had his conversion. He was already kind of trying to find what to do. But he would, and this is what he called it, he would go fishing. He'd go fishing, he'd throw out the line. He'd approach people on the street and start talking to them about anything. Anything. And if anything caught their interest, he would go. He would follow that line. And then he'd start turning the subject around sneakily. What he really wanted to do was to take this person to his room and run him or her through the spiritual exercises. But he snuck his way in. And that's what I did with this book. I knew I wanted to include all the religion, and actually not just include it. I knew, you know, instinctively, emotionally as well as rationally, that the religion was the central part of the story. But I snuck it in, and I snuck it in so well. My stealth technology was so good that, you know, Charles, most people don't consider this a religious book. Mm-hmm. They don't see it. The stealth is maybe a little too effective in many cases. I've only had one invitation in the 11 years since this book appeared, one invitation from a college that wanted to discuss the theology in the book. And that was Hartwick College in Montgomery, Alabama.
Huntington.
Is it in Huntington?
Is it Montgomery? Small Methodist school?
It used to be a girls' school, I think.
Maybe.
What did you say?
Huntington?
Yeah, Huntington. What did I say?
Yeah. Huntington.
Named after Matt Huntington.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they're the only people who ever asked me to discuss the theology. It does come up every now and then, but it's not, you know, it's... But I do get letters. I do get emails that focus on the religion. But it's easy for people to miss it. The theology in the book is, in fact, lived theology in the sense that a child comes into this world totally befuddled and is taught either at school or at home or at church that there is more to this world than meets the eye. And whether or not the lessons taught, in whatever way that they are taught, take hold, and a child comes to realize that, yes, there is something else. Even if it's through bad dreams where Jesus appears to them. That's as lived as theology gets. That's the nuclear family. And then what the nuclear family decides the child is going to be exposed to in terms of faith. Back to what I opened with, the airlift. Many years after I wrote the book, we invite this man to talk at Yale, Carlos Franchi. He was Fidel Castro's propaganda minister for many years. And then he had a falling out because Franchi considered himself a genuine socialist and considered Castro a bad socialist. So he was purged and went into exile. But he came to talk to us at Yale from his lair in Paris. And I sat next to him at dinner. And I elbowed him. I'd had a couple of glasses of wine. I elbowed him. And in Spanish, anyone who shares your first name, there's a beautiful word in Spanish, tocayo. There's no equivalent in English. I elbowed him and said, tocayo, tell me. You guys knew about the families being broken up, right? You knew about the kids, and you knew about the parents not being able to reunite with the kids. So, yeah, sure. Made us very happy. Anything that would destroy the bourgeois family was in our favor. No secret to him. No secret to a lot of people. This is key. It's key. People who have religious conversions later in life, despite their upbringing, like my lovely wife Jane, who grew up part Methodist, part Episcopalian, part nothing. And I think the nothing was larger than the other two. And then converted to Catholicism in graduate school. Where have they picked up that? God works in mysterious ways. But that part, that's another story, a whole different story about, you know, lived theology. But writing about religion in a personal way, when I am a historian and I'm supposed to be detached and objective, is quite a challenge. I am now two people, two very different people, two very different authors or writers. And very seldom do the two intersect. And only once was I foolish enough to accept an invitation that asked me to talk about both of my writing styles or writing fields. And it was at the University of Pennsylvania. And it was a total disaster. I made people squirm. People walked out. I got hate mail afterwards. And well, it didn't feel comfortable seeing people squirm in their seats and avoid eye contact and walk out and send you hate mail. It's kind of tough. Because if you make religion too real, and if you actually speak your mind about certain things in an academic setting, you can make people extremely uncomfortable. Extremely uncomfortable. And one of my graduate students, once coming back from her research in Germany, was riding the limousine from Kennedy Airport back to New Haven, and heard these other Yale students talking in the car about how awful they thought it was that some professors in the religious studies department at Yale actually believe in what they teach. And then my name came up, and she told them to shut up. Thank you, Mary. But it is risky. It is enormously risky. And when you put it out on the line, that in fact, as a historian, I do believe, I not only believe in God, I believe there's more than meets the eye in so many different ways, but I actually begin to argue that religion is a real thing, as real as salt and pepper, guns, anything else, rock salt, you name it, and people are motivated by their belief and that the belief is real. You can get into trouble. So memoirs are a lot safer because they tend not to be read by the scholarly. They're read by individuals who then, many of them actually have thanked me. I've only gotten two pieces of hate mail for my memoirs. One was because I used foul language. The other, I couldn't quite make it out. But the man was wishing me and my entire family nothing but hellfire for eternity. But all the other ones were positive. And here's another funny thing about the religion angle, writing without footnotes, is that first time I did it, I had no idea who my audience would be. I had no audience in mind. None whatsoever. I was just telling a story as I wanted to tell it. I didn't know who was going to be reading this book. Turns out I ended up having two very different audiences, which can then be broken down into different subgroups. But the major two groups are Cubans and non-Cubans. The Cubans don't focus on the religion too much, if at all. What they say, I found most interesting, and actually I feared my Cuban audience. I didn't have them in mind, but I feared them because Cubans are hypercritical. Hypercritical, one of them. If God forbid you have spinach on your teeth. They'll be talking about it for the next 50 years. But 99.9% of the responses I've had from Cubans all say thank you. And the weirdest thing is that they say thank you for telling my story. They don't say thank you for telling your story. They say thank you for telling my story. And then they divide into subgroups too. The two major ones are people who say thank you. And these are the children and grandchildren of Cuban exiles. And say thank you for confirming all the stories my family told me that I never believed. Or thank you for telling the stories my family found too painful to tell. More of these. More of the, you know, I didn't believe it. And here's another shocking fact. When people see a story in paper, it becomes believable. More believable than when I hear it from their own family, from other people. That's what I've discovered from this kind of mail that I've received. Among non-Cubans, I receive all kinds of wonderful mail. Now it's almost a ritual around Christmas time near December. I talk via Skype to a class of seniors in English class in Arizona. Every now and then a religious question comes up, but it's a public school, you see. It's a public school, so you have to be very careful about what you do in that situation. The theology that I work out in Waiting for Snow is one of divine providence. You know, as I said in the preamble, you know, all the characters are created by God's imagination, and all the events were preordained. And I really do believe that in a very strange way. Call it quantum theology. You know, I believe it's possible to have free will and absolute predestination simultaneously. Just like Heisenberg observed the particles going this way and that. I followed that up in the second memoir, which is even more theological and more religious. But here's the odd thing. I had learned many tricks about how to write a memoir by the time I got to the second one. Learned them so well that instead of doing it in 3 months, I did it in 6 weeks. And I did it the same way over one summer. And the seminar helped me a lot. You know, our meetings in New York helped me a lot. But it's a better book, much better, as a literary work, as literature. It's better. The theology is clearer. I have an even clearer message to get across. But the book didn't do very well. Here's the funniest thing that happened. When the book was announced, the AARP contacted me immediately because they thought it was a book about old people going to die in Florida. And when they found out it was not, then they were kind of disappointed. The book has been remaindered. It's only sold 20,000 copies. I see it on Amazon for 99 cents. It kind of hurts, you know. But it's better because the theology in there is, you know, continues the providential perspective, enlarges on it, but the title title, Learning to Die, in Miami. I learned a lesson. Don't put death in the title. That doesn't help too much. But, again, an echo of my father's beliefs in reincarnation, but in a Christian context, is that we all die many times in our lives. We die and we become someone else. And in order to grow, in order to progress, in order to thrive in this world, you know, one has to learn to die to oneself. Not just die and become a different person, but also, in the process, also die to oneself and start caring more for others. I have yet to hear feedback or echo on this in the way that I would have liked to have heard it. The narrative, perhaps, is too good, too odd, and that's what grabs people's attention. Waiting for Snow has been translated into 14 different languages. But no publisher in Spain or any Spanish-speaking country in Latin America wants the book. Not one. The Brazilians translated it and published it, but in Spain, I've got nothing but awful rejections about my stupid little stories. The fact that the stories seem charming, perhaps exotic, to non-Cuban readers was brought to light most intensely for me and most disturbingly when the book was picked up by a British publisher. And I get back the book, not the manuscript, I get back the book completely cut to shreds. Not only are my words switched, but great sections are taken out with very clear instructions. You must take out every single reference to religion and politics. Because we British are too sophisticated for such stuff, basically, is what it said. We're too sophisticated. People are going to be turned off by all your religious talk and all your politics. So what he wanted was a travelogue. You know, a colorful account. And he thought that's what the British would like to see. I told him, no, thank you. No. And then Simon & Schuster forced them to publish it as it is, but then they got their revenge on me by doing absolutely no publicity and actually putting the most offensive possible picture on the cover, which was a boy in his underwear sitting on these bleachers at some baseball stadium with a giant poster of Che Guevara behind him. And actually, come to think of, you know, prejudice, the German publisher refused to use my photograph because I didn't look Cuban enough. So, there you have it. The Dutch publisher found some two street urchins who looked like they had just, come out of a concentration camp, again shirtless, and put them on the cover. The religion? It was embarrassing to the British, but at least the other people who published it in all these other languages, they, you know. Learning to Die has not been translated or picked up anywhere. Waiting for Snow and Learning to Die and all my other books are banned in Cuba. I am an official enemy of the state. I got a call from the U.S. State Department back in 2003 or 2004 in informing me of this. Best honor I have ever received. People ask me, have you ever been back to Cuba? Don't ask me that question today. I'm warning you. Don't ask me that question. I haven't been back. No. But how do you sum up writing religion without footnotes? When it's personal, you don't need footnotes. None whatsoever. You know, perhaps it would have helped to have had a footnote explaining, for instance, my father's family were theosophists. And actually, it was a dissertation here. You remember Mike Ashcraft?
Yes, I do.
Okay, Mike Ashcraft's dissertation let me know that the American Theosophical Society had its most successful mission in Cuba. And second most successful was Brazil. And I had grown up with all this and wondered, why is my father's family so strange? Well, the missionaries from Philadelphia, from Madame Blavatsky, got to them and to a lot of other people in their acquaintance. When it's personal, you don't need footnotes, though. So what if people think that your father is a kook and perhaps that you're a kook? This is one thing, if you read the Gospels enough, you know that Jesus was not afraid of offending people. That sometimes you have to offend people, and people will think that you're crazy, as his relatives did when they came to get him. He's going, your family's out there, and they all think you're crazy. Or when, after expelling demons from people, they asked them, please don't ever come back. Do not come back. It's mysterious, but that's the way it is. You know, at age 50, you start to care less about how people think of you. As you reach 60, you care even less because you start to look like your grandfather or your grandmother. And then you care less and less. And you show up to talk to your class, to give a class or a lecture, with your zipper open. And a student in the front row has to come up and say, Professor, your fly's open.
You did that when you were 40, though.
Yes, I did, yeah.
just to be clear.
Yes. But offending people, you realize by that age that sometimes it's absolutely necessary. And if they find your religion offensive, and if they find your theology offensive, well, so be it. That's the way it's going to be. And that's the parable of the sower, right? Not to sound more like a preacher than a historian, but you know, historians too. This is what I've discovered too, now that in my advanced years, dealing with the history of the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Reformation, right? And the fact that religion and theology in the 16th century were totally inseparable from every aspect of life, and especially from politics. And that people's beliefs are multi-layered and very complex. There's a matrix of interconnected points in people's beliefs. And one of my obsessions as a scholar has always been, what motivates people to act the way that they do, especially in regards to religion? And people's beliefs do shape their behavior. In the 16th and 17th century, especially so. But what I've come to realize at my advanced age is that, you know, in our own day and age, in the early 21st century, in the free societies of the world, politics has become more like religion was in the 16th and 17th century. And people have deeply held beliefs. And you can no more convince someone to change their political beliefs than you could change someone's beliefs in the 16th or 17th century, especially when it comes to some issues. You can talk to your blue in the face. You're not going to change their mind. And their whole life is shaped by these beliefs. And the line between religion and politics is not at all where news stories put it. It's simply in the belief that people have in that certain things are right, certain things are wrong. It's more ethical, if you want to put it that way, than religious. But writing about this, I'm done with my Reformation survey, which I began in 1999. And then I did a few other things in between. But I got back the reader's reports back in March. All three readers, but one in particular, was immensely offended by my preface and my conclusion, in which I tried to get personal about religion and its place in history. And actually, I could argue with them. I could argue with everyone else about some of the things that I said, including the fact that there are still many historians who think that religion is an epiphenomenon. It's never the real thing. You know, it's something caused by social, political, and economic factors. It's a reflex rather than something real in and of itself. There are still many. I would say the majority. Everyone took offense with that. So, I took it out. I took it out because why? Why distract the poor students who are going to read this book? And why attract attention over a subject that I could argue, but it really is not worth arguing because you're not going to change anybody's mind about it. We had another lecturer at Yale who opened my eyes very wide about this in particular, and actually made me very grateful to God for having me go crazy to write these books. Because he came to lecture to us about religious violence in India. And the lecture was about how there is no religious violence in India. Because religion never motivates anyone to do anything. It's always economic, social, political, racial, ethnic. Religion is not a factor in history. And when I and several others pressed him on this, he started to get emotional. And finally he blurted, I says, "Look, I'm an atheist. I'm an atheist and I don't believe in God. Since God is not real, religion can't be real, and religion never drives people to do anything." And this man is a tenured professor in the California university system and is invited to give talks about religious violence. So, it's a complex picture, you know, and it's not easy to put into words how I relate my work as a historian with my work as a memoirist, and in between, in both, as a believing religious person and a believing Christian. And how long have I gone on for? What time is it?
Well, if you don't mind,
questions? Yeah, sure.
I think you've given us.
I'll just have one more anecdote to close it up,
please,
and then
perfect.
Everything was brought into focus for me at a scholarly meeting, and it was actually a very interesting thing that happened because the conference was in Paris. And I had just received an email from one of my former neighbors in Havana, boy I knew, who was living in Paris working for UNESCO. And he said, "Well, let's meet up. You're coming. Let's meet up." So I met up with him. First thing he asks me is, "Do you remember me coming to see you off at the airport?" And actually, in the book, I say, none of my friends came to the airport. But he hadn't read the book yet. So I had to say, "You know, I'm sorry, I don't remember you being there. I don't remember you at all." And then he said, "Funny thing, you shouldn't remember me, because that's the day that changed my life. And that was my first step towards prison." Because a few years later, he said the wrong thing to the wrong person, and he ended up spending 8 years in prison for criticizing the regime. He said, "Seeing my family split up is what began him on the road to thinking maybe this is not so good." And he spent 4 of those years totally naked because he refused to wear the same prison uniform as common criminals. Thousands of Cuban prisoners have done this, and it gets cold in December. But here's the kicker to the conference was at dinner one night, someone with very bad manners. And if there's one thing I learned by living in Virginia for 15 years, is that manners are very important. Someone said, oh, you know, Carlos won the National Book Award. Nobody had heard this around the table. None of the historians, American and European, no one knew this. So they all looked puzzled. They said, for what? For what book? So I explained the book. And guy sitting right across the table from me, who has competed for every job that I also applied for, scrunched his face and actually made a sound like he'd been punched in the gut. He went, ooh. He said, oh, you know what that means. I said, no, what? What does it mean? He says, it means you're going to be remembered for that book, not for your work as a historian. I said, I can live with that. But then the French historian who organized the conference did what only a French historian can do, which is to be pithy and cruel to the utmost at the same time. And he said, well, you certainly won't win a prize for the paper you gave us today. But guess what? It's the only paper I have ever received thank you notes for. It's the only piece of scholarly work that I actually still get thank you notes for. So something happened, right? Something arced between the two. But that kind of sums it up, and now I open it up for questions.
Can you open the microphone when they ask the questions?
It won't make you louder, but it will catch your words.
Carlos, thank you. It is such an honor to know you. You've been an inspiration to me, I must say. My question, to be pithy but not French pithy, I read Waiting for Snow as part of the first seminar. So I read it, you know, not knowing you, not knowing anything. And it was part of my brain. It's been part of my brain cells as I've reread it over the years. And then when you wrote the second book, that's been at the front of my brain cells. And that's been the book I've reread whenever I go back to reread your fiction. Mm-hmm. And you coming here today made me go back to Waiting for Snow and reread it again. And what really struck me that had never struck me before was the difference between the two books. The first book, Waiting for Snow, it really struck me how much trauma is in that book, and how much violence is in that book, and it felt like an exorcism of intense trauma and violence. And this may be obvious to you, but it really, really struck me that this is a child going through this experience of acute internal trauma and violence, not just the outside. And so, could you say something about the difference of writing the two books? Clearly writing about trauma has an internal emotional effect on one, whereas the second book doesn't strike me as that much. So how did they differ? Yeah.
I think, you know, when you... Life is messy and traumatic in and of itself. You add a revolution and a totalitarian regime to the mix, and the trauma goes through the roof. It's a geometric progression. I think that's... First answer that comes to my mind to your question. But there's also the fact that there's a difference in age. The stories, two different boys in terms of age. And the first memoir, as I said a few moments ago, you know, we're coming to this world befuddled and we're trying to make sense out of it. And it's the total befuddlement at all this. The second one, I felt, here's what I did with both. Let me back up one step. I think I did some self-hypnosis, because as I was writing, I was reliving my life. Of course, I was reliving it as a 50-year-old man and a 59-year-old man. But I went back. Right? And in the second one, I'm more in control. I'm not as befuddled anymore. Not trying to make as much sense of it. There's not as much violence around me. There's other sorts of trauma. The toughest audience I've ever had was the Florida Psychoanalytic Association. They invited me to be their keynote speaker because they were doing their session that year was on childhood trauma. So I gave a lecture filled with jokes that I know make people laugh. Not a sound. Then I realized they're all Freudians. You know, they can't respond to you. They can't respond. They can't laugh. But in fact, I was there as a poster child for childhood trauma. Not because I hadn't written the second book yet. It was the, you know, yeah, you're right. The first one is full of... And actually, I didn't put everything in there. There's more that I couldn't bring myself to put in.
Thanks, Heather. Just briefly, could you tell us how you were reunited with your mother? And if bourgeois families are frowned upon, is there any good sort of family in that regime?
Oh, there was to be no family other than the state.
Oh.
You know, children were to be distanced from their parents, given a totally different set of values from those of their parents to create the new man and the new woman. And it was the state that was in charge of everyone, of keeping the adults silent, breaking up their relationship with their children, and making sure that the children had the right mindset. So that's what they were after, and that's what they're still after, 55 years later. It's a hideous kind of situation, but true nonetheless, that breaking the parent's bond with the child is the best way to ensure that the child won't be like the parent and won't have the same beliefs. And my mom, took her 3.5 years to leave. She finally left after 3.5 years and was immediately sent to Chicago by a social worker in Miami, because there were no jobs in Miami. So my brother and I joined her after being basically on our own for 3.5 years.
But how did she find you?
Oh, no, we wrote letters.
We were in touch.
We could write letters, and we could request phone calls that were 3 minutes in length with somebody listening at the other end. So we communicated. She knew where we were and knew where to find us, so. Yeah, up here in front.
Thank you. It's been really inspiring to hear your... Is this working? Can you hear me?
Is it on?
Okay. It's been really inspiring to hear about your writing process as well. And also, I'm really interested in the issue of being a scholar of religion and simultaneously being a religious person, a person who respects religion. And you mentioned not writing this book until after you had tenure.
Yes.
What are the other options? Having done that, what is your advice?
A pen name.
Ah.
A pen name. Which actually I asked for also. Once they wanted to leave in all the bad stuff, I said, no, I need a pen name. And they said, no, you can't have a pen name. You have to be careful before tenure because there are still far too many scholars around who have very narrow vision of what scholarship should be. And right here in Cock Hall, my very first tenure case that I took part in after I received tenure, I heard two colleagues say about another colleague who was coming up for tenure that he didn't deserve tenure because he wrote poetry. That meant he wasn't serious. There are still people like that. But it's getting better. It's getting better. We just hired someone in the history department at Yale, Deborah Harkness. Any of you read her novels about vampires and so on? She writes vampire novels. Set in Elizabethan England. Oh boy, was there a pushback on that appointment. But she made it. She made it, yeah. But yeah, no, it's just like, you know. Do vampires count as religion? I guess maybe in the 16th century they did. 16th, 17th century they did.
Yeah. The president of the university's son that has done the American religious history is looking at this. That's part of
what?
His.
Oh yeah.
His study. He's Mr. Vampire.
We have 5 or 6 more minutes if there are more questions. Valerie's here.
Yeah, thank you for your book. I wish I had read it before I visited Cuba because it explained a lot to me of what I saw. I went there 3 years ago. The incredible melange of religious influences and the ways that people's homes are decorated, you know, San Lazaro with the
That's
duck.
That's right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I wish I could have gotten my camera out fast enough. Yeah. He was there in the burlap with a pedigree dog. People dressed up like St. Lazarus. It was like Lazarus right. and the rich man in Luke 16. I mean, not a real guy. Right.
right? But he's really not Lazarus.
No.
You know, this is the African religion covered up with a Catholic saint.
Right. Can you speak to the racial dynamics a little bit more? You touch on it in the book. Spend some time in Santiago, which is the blackest part
That's right.
of Cuba, and the Virgin of Caridad, who's a mixed race woman, but right. Jesus is still white. And
Well, here's the deal. Cuba was sugar for a long time, and Cuba actually had a railroad before Spain. British built the railroad in Cuba decades before Spain had a railroad for the sugar. But, of course, sugar meant slaves. Mm-hmm. And as I have learned, sugar is so labor-intensive that your slaves die off in high numbers, which meant that Cuba kept receiving new and new waves of African migrants. Mm-hmm. Slaves. Mm-hmm. So Christianizing them was very difficult. Unlike the plantations here in the United States, where you've got one generation, second, by the fourth generation, everybody's nicely Christianized. In Cuba, it was much harder to do that. But here's the, for me, the mind-blowing part about race relations in Cuba, is that there were many freed slaves by the late 19th century who were leading the war against Spain for freedom. And one of the greatest national heroes in Cuba, Antonio Maceo, was a mulatto. Mm-hmm. He's known as the Bronze Titan. But there were, former freed slaves, second, third generation freed, who were wealthy and were living like everyone else. But you still had this enormous population of slaves until 1888. My father's parents, who were born in Cuba, when they were born in 1870, there were slaves around. One day I woke up to the fact that every elderly black person I met as a child could have been a slave, could have been born a slave. Because, from 1888 to 1950, yes, those people were definitely still around. When Cuba gained independence from Spain in 1902, Cuban population was 80% African, 20% white. Between 1902 and 1959, it's a huge wave of European migration to Cuba because Cuba was very prosperous, and Europe was not, and Europe was having wars. So in 1959, population of Cuba was 30% black, 70% white. It is now 70-30 the other way. And countries run by the military, all the generals are white. And if they're black, they're very light-skinned. They still have the skin thing. If you're really dark Cuban, forget it. And guess who are the leaders of the dissident movement in Cuba? They're all dark-skinned African Cubans. All the really tough ones who just won't take any guff. There's a lot of racism. Have you read Eugene Robinson's book, Last Dance in Havana? Wonderful book. Eugene Robinson went down there to check out the music scene. And then, much to his surprise, because, you know, he had read in every American newspaper and magazine that racism had been abolished in Cuba and believed it, much to his surprise, he found that he was constantly being harassed by the police, most of whom are white. And he wrote a wonderful book, both about the music scene and about this.
The Washington Post?
Yeah, the Washington Post. Last Dance in Havana. And what he tells in this book is that he was constantly being stopped and asked for his identity card simply because of the color of his skin. The National Assembly, the Congress, which is a one-party Congress, and everyone is forced to vote for the one candidate. Every time I look at the picture for the new Congress, I try to look at the percentage. It is not 70-30. It's actually more like 90-10, 90% white, 10% black. It's still horrible.
But were the African descendants initially the major supporters of the revolution? I mean,
there was a lot of support,
right,
because of the rhetoric, mm-hmm, and because of the social programs.
Mm-hmm.
But quickly people find out, mm-hmm, when they have their own children and they see that their children are not moving ahead, and it's the white neighbors' children who get the top spots, mm-hmm, and so on. So there's one man, a Cuban of Jamaican descent, Carlos Moore, M-O-R-E, wrote a wonderful book, Pichon, in which he details his own run-in with Fidel Castro, because Moore was a communist. But he had the nerve to tell Fidel Castro at one point, your rhetoric is incorrect. You keep saying we no longer have racism, but believe me, we have racism. And he ended up in prison simply for pointing out that there was still racism in Cuba. So it's a complicated and very sad picture. Add this other layer to it. Right now, there are 2 million Cubans in exile. And about 1 million, about half of them, have come to the U.S. since 1992. And this group, this demographic, sends a lot of money to their relatives in Cuba. Black people in Cuba have very few relatives in exile, which means last year the figure was, in 2013, in remittances alone from the United States, $3 billion that go to the white Cubans. And the disparity keeps growing. I don't know if you were able to see all this.
Yeah,
I saw
the two currencies. The two currencies.
Yeah, the two
currencies.
That's right.
I mean, it was crazy. The black people were using the...
The Cuban peso.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And couldn't go into certain stores and stuff. It was crazy.
That's right. It's sad.
Well, I think... I thank you so much for this hour and a half.
Thank you.
Sharing with us these moving, inspiring, difficult stories, and helping us think about our own vocations as scholars and writers.
Thank you for the invitation.
Giving us the sense of freedom to write religion without footnotes.
And actually, there's a footnote. It's so nice to see people using Spanish fans. Because... that's, talk about religion when I was a child. That was it. Men were not allowed to use fans.
Hmm.
It was only the women who had fans and would whip them open and close them, and then they could fan their kids.
Mm-hmm.
The little girls could have fans, but the boys, my mom used to have to fan me. I couldn't grab the fan myself. It was not macho to have a fan. But it's nice to see the Spanish fans.
So thanks to all of you for making this such a special afternoon, for enduring the heat, and for being part of this conversation.
Thank you.